Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 86. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing science fiction and horror back to back. A couple of old movies, one from 1956, one from 1960, one from America, one from England, one about flying saucers, one about vampires. So the first one we're going to take a look at is the 1956 Columbia Pictures movie Earth vs. the Flying Saucers with Hugh Marlowe and Joan Taylor, with special effects of course by the late great Ray Harryhausen. Then we go on to 1960 and across the Atlantic Ocean for Hammer Horror's second vampire movie, Brides of Dracula, starring Peter Cushing and Yvonne Molnauer. So basically, yeah, flying saucers and vampires, 1956, 1960, one in black and white, one in colour, but both of them a lot of fun. So sit back and I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we'll move on with the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hi people, how are you doing? I should mention at the start, in case people don't listen to Paleo Cinema Podcast as well, a couple of weeks ago, podcasting lost a very good friend in Vince Rotolo from the B-Movie Podcast. I've talked about Vince in the last Paleo Cinema, but Vince's funeral was a few days ago, and apparently there was a lot of love for him on the internet and elsewhere, and he'll be missed. Vince was a lovely guy. I podcasted with him once, and I miss him already. He really was supportive of this podcast and also of Paleo Cinema Podcast. He shared his knowledge of podcasting. He was really a great guy, and I miss him. But I'm not going to talk as much about Vince as I did on Paleo Cinema. If you're more interested, please listen to the last one of those. I'm going to get on with the podcast now. Oh, it's Mother's Day today, by the way. I did call my mum. I called up to Sydney and talked to my mother. She is suffering from some dementia, but she kind of loses words rather than ideas. And so we had a brief chat, and I wished her happy Mother's Day. I'm sending her up a present. And it was kind of good to do that. I'm not sure how many more times I get to do that, which is one of those things that we all face as time goes on. But it feels good to kind of reconnect more than I have recently. My own life here in Melbourne unfortunately interferes. But happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. All my best wishes too to the people who can't be mothers or haven't become mothers, or who are the mothers to pets. I think it's just a day for appreciating people in general. And that's something that I'm very much in favour of as a principle. And as Dean Martin once said in the Sans Hotel on stage, mother is half a word. I was actually going to start this podcast earlier today, but I got distracted. And distraction is something that comes very easily when you're sitting in the man cave, because there's so much shit in here that I can kind of go off at a tangent the way you can when you're clicking on the internet. So I decided I didn't know where my 45 RPM records were, and I didn't, because they were all in a pile behind a stack of books on the shelf. And so I had to kind of do a bit of tidy up and then try to find them, and I finally found them. And I went, okay, well, I've got this new $40 record player that I bought, and if you want to look at my Facebook page, you can see a picture of it. I want to actually record a couple of these singles, because you can't find them anywhere on the internet. Even iTunes don't sell some of them, because that's how obscure my taste in music is. And so, of course, I had to get out, I had to record, and I had to transcribe onto USB a couple of my old 45s, just because I thought of it. And maybe I'm getting obsessive compulsive disorder, I don't know, or maybe I'm just on a Sunday afternoon when it's raining outside and there's not too much to do and my coffee grinder just broke and I had to go out and buy another one. I just wanted to chill out for a little bit before I did the podcast, and that's exactly what I did. By the way, I did get a new coffee grinder, and at the same time, my in-laws gave me the money they were giving me for my birthday last month, and so I have spent it well. I spent it on Denner JB Hi-Fi. They had a 20% off DVDs and Blu-ray sale. So for the $50 I got from them, they give you $50 and a card like you're 12 years old, but I love it anyway. I bought the Jacques Tati box set of all of Jacques Tati's movies on Blu-ray for $50. So I'm quite pleased with that. I bought a grown-up bunch of movies, and it's something that I will treasure and I will watch again, and I'll probably podcast more Jacques Tati movies as time goes on. If you don't know who he is, please Google him, because he's an important person in the history of comedy cinema. But anyway, it's time to crank up the Letterboxd without the E, second E, and see what I've been watching since the last time I spoke with the planet Earth on the internet. Let me just bring it up now. By the way, the rain's quite welcome around here because it hasn't been raining a lot. And while I'm there, shout out to Canada at the moment with those bushfires you guys have got. We're more familiar with them than you are. And yeah, it's not cool and not nice. And yeah, yuck. There's only really two movies I've watched. I'm not sure what else I've been doing. I think I've been playing too much Xbox, but there are two movies I've watched since the last time I put these headphones on. And one of them is a really low-budget Columbia motion picture called Serpent of the Nile, starring Rhonda Fleming and William Lundigan. And it's like they're trying to do Cleopatra a few years before the big Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra on the budget of a film noir. The sets are rudimentary. It's in bright technicolor. The technicolor is eye-poppingly good. It's in bright technicolor, and it's got Raymond Burr in it and a whole bunch of other character actors just before they became big in other ways. And it's kind of fun. The best fun I had with it, though, was watching the low-budget filmmaking and the sets. Basically, one of the sets is a table, a chair, and a big curtain in the background. It's that kind of limited budget stuff, and they may be using crowd scenes from other movies that Columbia had the rights to and all that kind of stuff. So that was a bit of fun to watch. I quite enjoyed that. Then I watched a movie that was incredibly big in 1974. It was one of the biggest movies of the year. It got into all the big cinemas here in Australia. The Plaza, I think, in Sydney had it. And it is Irwin Allen's The Towering Inferno, starring Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, Faye Dunaway, William Holden. It's got one of those cast of thousands. Fred Astaire's in it. O.J. Simpson's in it. It's crazy. It's basically about a fire in a high-rise. Robert Wagner's in it as well. And the high-rise is like 120 stories tall. It's the tallest building in San Francisco. And Paul Newman plays the architect. Steve McQueen plays the fire chief. William Holden plays the guy who kind of shorted out the wiring to save money. And it's one of those great big blockbuster films, kind of like The Poseidon Adventure. Same people made it, actually, The Poseidon Adventure. And it's really fun to watch. Sal and I sat down and watched it and enjoyed it a lot. The special effects are, for the time, very good. And there's some really grueling scenes of people's deaths. Some people we kind of like die in this movie. And actually, I found it quite gripping at times, even though Irwin Allen and the people he got in, I think John Gilliman was the director, but Irwin Allen directed the effects shots. Even though the direction's not the best, it's still pretty good. It holds up pretty well. I picked it up on Blu-ray. I couldn't get an Australian Blu-ray, so I found one on eBay for like $12, including postage from America. See, that's what happens to the Patreon money. I go and buy movies like this, which I'll eventually talk about in the podcast. So I picked that up and I was quite pleased with it. I hadn't seen it since the 1970s and I quite enjoyed it. But anyway, I'm going to start the actual movies I'm going to talk about first. We'll do them in chronological order and start out with Earth versus the Flying Saucer.
Flying saucers have invaded our planet. Washington, London, Paris, Moscow are key targets. The whole world is under attack. Can it survive?
We are the survivors of a disintegrated solar system. At this moment, the remainder of our fleet is circling your globe.
What do you want with me?
Arrange for your world leaders to confer with us in the city of Washington.
They set up an electronic screen. The artillery doesn't penetrate.
Never before has the screen reached such heights of excitement. Breathtaking spectacle. Hair-raising terror. See the saucer men's high-frequency disintegrator. See flying saucers travel thousands of miles in seconds. See great cities leveled by flying saucer monsters.
Russ, look.
The same kind of thing that's watched us since the beginning of the project.
People of Earth, attention. People of Earth, attention. This is a voice speaking to you from thousands of miles beyond your planet.
They're coming down to take over. They made that clear to us in the saucer.
To the best of our knowledge, my wife and I are the only ones left alive.
Earth vs. the Flying Saucers is a 1956 American science fiction movie starring Hugh Marlowe, Morris Ancrum, Joan Taylor, who has the most generic name of any actress in 1950s cinema. Even though she wasn't a bad actress, she worked for Columbia for a while. She had a contract with them. The movie was part of Columbia's B picture unit. Columbia's head at the time was a guy called Harry Cohn, who people hated, but who produced a whole bunch of good movies. He dropped dead of a heart attack in 1958, a couple of years after this film came out. But just for curiosity's sake, I was looking at a list of Columbia motion pictures from, say, 1954 to 1956. You've got things like, on the top side, you've got things like The Caine Mutiny and On the Waterfront, amongst other things. Picnic and those kind of quality A pictures. Then you've got some interesting lower-budget things like The Mad Magician with Vincent Price and The Saracen Blade, The Law versus Billy the Kid, Cannibal Attack, I'd have to see that one, that sounds good. Pirates of Tripoli, Five Against the House, and then it came from beneath the sea, Creature from the Atom, Creature with the Atom Brain, which is their reaction against the Universal films that were just starting to come big. Things like Tarantula and all that kind of stuff were starting to come. Then they did some really cool, they even did musicals like My Sister Eileen, which has got Bob Fosse in it, in a couple of the really best dance sequences of the 1950s. As I said, Picnic with Kim Novak and William Holden, which is fantastic. Joe Macbeth, Cockleshell Heroes, which is a pretty much standard World War II thing. They also distributed and produced Humphrey Bogart's last movie, The Harder They Fall, in 1956. The Eddie Duchin Story, which is a movie I kind of like for a couple of different scenes in it. The movie 1984, the 1956 version with Edmund O'Brien and Jan Sterling in it. So basically they went from doing some really top quality products, including a year after this movie came out, after Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, they released Bridge on the River Kwai, amongst other things, pretty spectacular. And a movie I recently talked about on Paleo Cinema Podcast in 1958, Bonjour Tristesse, with Gene Seberg and David Niven. So, you know, they're a pretty good studio, but their B picture unit produced some really interesting lower budget stuff in the 1950s, which I found very cool, and into the early 1960s as well. So, I've seen a few things from them lately, and there have been a few box sets of various Columbia genre films released fairly cheaply. You can get them on Amazon, which show that there were some kind of, they're not A pictures, they're not like Forbidden Planet or This Island Earth, they're not at that level. But there's still some interesting genre films, and Earth vs. the Flying Saucers is definitely one of them. You got Hugh Marlowe playing Dr. Russell Marvin, and his wife Carol, who's an ex-secretary, is played by Joan Taylor. Morris Ancrum's in there as her father, Brigadier General John Hanley. John Zaremba, who was in a whole bunch of Owen Allen things in the 1960s, like Time Tunnel, played one of the scientists in Time Tunnel, is in there. And a few other kind of actresses, actors, a bunch of other actors who were kind of from the Columbia Studios pool of actors, who you know their faces, but you don't necessarily know their names. People like Grandin Rhodes and people like that. And, of course, the voice, as you heard in the trailer, of Paul Frees, who did a lot of stuff for Disney in the 60s and produced an album where he sang 1960s pop songs with the voices of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, and that an album called Paul Frees Meets the Poster People, which was one of the first LPs I bought for reasons that now elude me. But anyway, I later found out that Paul Frees was dobbing everybody into the FBI and was a big informant for the FBI. So I never liked Paul Frees after that because he was one of those assholes who named names and behind things worked to make the Blacklist work, which is a bit odd because this movie was partly written by one of the actors, one of the writers on the Blacklist, Bernard Gordon. His credit is for Raymond T. Marcus, but it's actually Bernard Gordon, who was one of the Blacklisted writers. The screen story is written by Kurt Siogmak, who'd done a whole bunch of different genre films in the 40s and 1950s, and is well known, but it's based on a book by an ex-Marine called Donald E. Kehoe, who suggested that flying saucers, he was one of the first people to suggest that flying saucers were from outer space and had aliens and were basically inimical to human beings. He's responsible for a lot of bad films, in other words, Donald Kehoe. But Earth vs. Flying Saucers isn't necessarily one of them. Earth vs. Flying Saucers I find really kind of interesting. You've got to accept that they got the husband and wife team there, and you've got that kind of sexual politics from the 1950s where he's telling her to go and hide, and she doesn't go and hide and ends up being in trouble with him when the aliens attack. It's, yeah, you've got to kind of go, okay, yeah, that stuff was shit. From our point of view, that stuff is definitely shit, but it's part of what things were. The plot's fairly simple, really. I'll kind of paraphrase from Wikipedia. Scientist Dr. Russell Marvin, Hugh Marlowe, and his new bride, Carol Joan Taylor, are driving to work at a rocket site. They're actually launching the first satellites ever, 12 satellites that are being launched around the Earth by the Americans to kind of monitor radiation from the sun and all that kind of thing. They're driving to work when a flying saucer appears overhead, without proof of the encounter other than a tape recording of the ship's sound. Dr. Marvin is hesitant to notify his superiors. He's in charge of Project Skyhook, an American space program that already launched 10 research satellites into orbit. General Hanley Morris Ankrum, Carol's father, informs Marvin that many of his satellites have since fallen back to Earth. Marvin admits he lost contact with all of them and privately suspects alien involvement. Marvin's then witnessed the 11th falling from the sky shortly after launch. When a saucer lands the Skyhook the next day, soldiers open fire, killing one of the exposed aliens, while others and the saucer itself are being protected by a force field. The aliens then kill everyone at the facility except the Marvins, who are down in the basement. General Hanley is captured and taken away by the saucer. Now too late, Russell discovers and decodes a message in his tape, on his tape recording from the aliens. They wanted to meet Dr. Marvin and had landed in peace at Skyhook for that purpose. Now impatient to conduct that meeting because everything has gone sideways, Marvin contacts the aliens and steals away to meet them. I won't go any further than that. So that's pretty much it. It's a fairly simple plot, and it's a plot that a whole bunch of other films subsequent to this have followed. Even things like Independence Day owe a little bit of a nod to Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Of course, Ray Harryhausen did the stop-motion effects of the flying saucers and the flying saucers crashing into buildings with his usual meticulous, painstaking way. Though he did say at one stage that this was his least favourite of his movies. I think because he wasn't really animating living things. He was animating buildings and he was animating fairly simply flying saucers and things like that. So it didn't have that kind of breath of realism that we like from Ray Harryhausen's stop-motion animation. I think he was at his best when he was doing living things of some kind. And even though the special effects in this are state-of-the-art for the time, even on a fairly low budget, which Harryhausen admitted the budget was fairly low, it was a B-picture budget trying to tell a very large story. They were telling a story of a worldwide invasion by aliens and human beings fighting back. And most of the fight back is two trucks with big sonic weapons on the back of it, driving around back lots and aiming up in the air for the flying saucers to be hit by the sonic weapons. And they kind of make it work because there are some shots on location where, if you watch carefully, you can tell they only really had two trucks with these things on the back of it. But the way they frame the shots and the way they film it gives the illusion that there are a lot more than that. And that's kind of cool. There are lots of other slips in the movie as well. They supposedly meet the alien spaceship on Chesapeake Bay, and the place where they land is very obviously a California beach and not anything like the landscape around Chesapeake Bay. But, you know, that happened in a lot of A pictures as well. It's really one of those things that studios took shortcuts with locations, trying to find the nearest location that looked a bit like something that was near the Hollywood studios. A lot of the films in the West, of course, set in the West, of course, were filmed around the Alabama Hills, which were, you know, about 80 miles northeast of Los Angeles, for instance. But I'm getting away from things. I kind of like this movie for a number of reasons. I like movies that bite off more than they can chew. And this one does most definitely do that. Trying to tell a story of a global invasion on a B-picture budget is ambitious. Most of the other stuff that they do is a bunch of people sitting around in either laboratories or in meeting rooms in office buildings talking about stuff. So you've got three things. You've got flying saucer special effects. You've got people having meetings and scientific lab analyses and people driving around in trucks with great big ray guns on the back of them. That's pretty much the movie. Hugh Marlowe's not bad as the hero, Russell Marvin, and Joan Taylor's quite good. She's got an interesting character there. It's underwritten the way all female characters were underwritten in these kind of movies. In fact, the male characters were as well. But given that the male characters got more screen time, they had more they could do with it. But one of the things that pisses me off about this movie is that kind of thing where there's only one woman in the whole film, and she's the wife of the hero, and she doesn't get to kind of be part of the solution. She's just there basically, so it's not an entire sausage fest. But that's how movies were in those days. And yeah, we can kind of learn from that mistake, and we can learn from having women disenfranchised by that kind of filmmaking. But on the other hand, there were women's pictures as well where men were just there to hold your handbag. But nonetheless, I think this movie could have done with a few women. I like women scientists in the movie 1950s, but when they're not kind of the end up just being there so they can scream when the monster attacks. There's some interesting women scientists in a couple of 1950s, and women are showing a bit of guts and determination being part of the solution to this kind of unexpected and unprecedented problem, rather than just being there for somebody to pash at the end of the film. Just noticed that Joan Taylor did a whole bunch of westerns, mostly TV stuff. Some of them for Screen Gems. Screen Gems was Columbia Pictures' television arm, and she did a bunch of those. She was also in a really interesting lowish budget Arabian Nights kind of movies, one of the few Hollywood films in the 1950s about a Persian poet, and that's Omar Khayyam, which starred Cornel Wilde, Michael Rennie, Deborah Padgett was in it as well, John Derrick, Raymond Massey, Yima Sumac, Sebastian Cabot, Morris Ankrum was in it as well, Ed Platt, who played the chief in Get Smart, of course, and way down the list, of course, we've got Joan Taylor, Henry Brandon was in it, I think they got some cool people, John Abbott, another great character actor. I'm going to have to re-watch Omar Khayyam, I think it's on YouTube, but I kind of got a soft spot, and I'm going to digress here a little bit. Excuse me while I do. But I've got a soft spot for Arabian Nights kind of movies of the 40s and 50s. Yes, they're politically correct. And yes, it's major cultural appropriation. But I like them. I saw a lot of them when I was a kid. I like the swashbuckling thing. They're as unrealistic about kind of medieval cultures as the movies set in medieval England are. So there's that kind of thing. But I kind of like them. They're a good excuse for women to wear skimpy costumes and to dance around. It was good to get novelty acts into dance. You had good chances for character actors to be evil wazirs and things like that. And you got the heroes to kind of fight with curved swords for a change instead of straight ones. But, I'm digressing big time from Earth versus Flying Saucers, but I just thought I'd throw that in and say, yes, even though they're politically correct and they're never going to make that kind of movie again since Prince of Persia dropped dead a number of years ago. But, yeah, well, I've got a fondness for them. And Earth versus Flying Saucers was made by the same studio. The aliens turned out to be quite interesting as well, and I would have liked to have seen more about the aliens. They said that the alien spacesuits, which are kind of generic, are made out of solidified electricity, which is kind of stupid, but we'll kind of let that go. And the technologies in them prove to be quite interesting as well. And they've also got in really powerful ray that shoot out of the arms of the... So they're kind of total repulsor ray, Tony Stark kind of bits in these suits. The suits are incredibly light. They have enhanced visual and hearing prostheses in them because, as they find out when they take the suit off one of the aliens... The aliens are really very old. They're the survivors of a lost race. But it looks like they, while they're searching for another planet, all of them have got old and they haven't reproduced. So they're kind of a doomed race, but nonetheless they want a planet. The special effects, as I said, by Ray Harryhausen are state of the art. One thing I found out that I didn't know about the special effects in this movie, because they're doing flying saucers, in every shot, and stop motion working, of course, one frame, move a little bit, another frame, move a little bit, in every shot, Ray Harryhausen and his people had to paint the wires holding the models up so that they matched the backgrounds and they wouldn't show in a special effects sequence. So where there was like a blue sky in the background, they had to paint each wire each time to look the same as it. It must have been crazily painstaking to do that. But the results are there. The spaceships do kind of work. They kind of hint at really cool technologies. The curving little ray gun that shoots out of the bottom of the spacecraft is one part of that. The fact that the body of the spacecraft rotates around the hub, which is something they got from Donald Kehoe's original book, which is very cool. I mean, there was nothing quite like these spaceships in movies before this time. It was kind of that they were the first real groovy looking flying saucers in American cinema. And, of course, ever since then, people have been doing that right up to... It probably reached its peak with the Close Encounters of the Third Kind that Spielberg did in the 1970s, late 1970s. I think it was 79, if I'm right. It kind of reached a peak with that where those enormous Christmas tree alien spaceships, you can draw a direct line through cinema from the simple stop-motion stuff that Ray Harryhausen did right up to those elaborate and... kind of empty and hollow and all spectacle, no wonder, spaceships from Close Encounters. A movie I'm not fond of, because as somebody pointed out once upon a time, it may have been Harlan Ellison, Close Encounters of the Third Kind is a cargo cult movie. It treats the human race like when natives building airstrips and building bamboo aeroplanes so that all the soldiers will come back in their aeroplanes and give us stuff. And my other problem with Close Encounters of the Third Kind is how emotionally manipulative it is. It really wants us to cry and laugh and feel the sense of wonder and is willing to beat us around the face and neck to make sure that happens. And I don't like that over-the-top manipulation. It's very blatant stuff. If you rewatch those kind of films now, the special, you know, the way that the music and the acting and the direction really try to manipulate us is pretty damn obvious and pretty annoying for that reason. Yes, I know this is a character flaw. I don't like Star Wars and I don't like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I must be an incredibly flawed human being, something which I have come to terms with over the years, by the way. But just to kind of wrap up Earth versus the Flying Saucers, I like it. I like that kind of 1950s technology, you see. They use a computer to do some of the translation from the alien language, yeah, with some very interesting technologies. And it's one of those old computers with lots of spindles and things. It was a computer that Alan Turing would not be unfamiliar with. And it's kind of cool to see those old technologies. It's kind of like the same way it's cool about a decade later to see those enormous computers they had with big banks of flashing lights and no circuit breakers in them. Nowadays, it's... all about the display and the computers themselves are fairly small. In fact, I was watching an episode, the first episode of the last season of Person of Interest, where they had to recreate a supercomputer to upload the benign AI into. And they used a whole bunch of PlayStations because it had actually been done in real life. They built a supercomputer out of PlayStation and the heroes in the Person of Interest had to do the same thing. And it kind of reminded me, for some reason I was reminded of that when I saw the computer in Earth versus the Flying Saucers, how we love to see the technology. Even though we know it works, it's good fun to see the kind of banks of servers in a modern thing with all the blue and the yellow wires hanging out of them. and the little blinky LED lights and all that kind of thing. We love that kind of stuff. And it's a visual shorthand for us, of course, to say this is a very powerful computer with lots of connections. And isn't it cool? But Earth vs. Flying Saucers is on that continuum. It's nice to watch the steps taken towards modern science fiction, where you start out with things that are kind of broad and primitive, and the special effects are ropey, and the characters are underwritten, and all that kind of thing. And watch as we move forward in time and see how the changes in our society and the changes in our technological society have impacted the alien invasion in this case. And it is fun to kind of go through that and kind of go, okay, this and this and this, and this is about that part of what was happening at the time, and this is about another part. And slowly, as time goes on, we get more and more interesting roles for women in these movies. Obviously not enough, but some. And Earth versus the Flying Saucers is towards the start of it. It's on the path. They showed, well, one of the things is that this kind of movie is the kind of 1950s drive-in fodder, which the people who made movies in the 80s watched when they were kids. People like Joe Dante and Alan Arkush and all of those kind of guys. And now, of course, the modern filmmakers are being influenced by the stuff that Joe Dante and Alan Arkush and the other guys and John Carpenter and all of those kind of people made in the 1980s. So there is a continuity there, and there is a kind of stream of filmmaking and love of the genre, which is passed on from movies like Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And so it gets some respect for that. It's a part of cinematic science fiction history, and we've got to acknowledge that and realize how cool it is.
In your sunken city, you're a billion light years distant, and the stars look very pretty from Relay. So close and yet so far away, E-I-E-A. Cthulhu Fatagin, or is that Cthulhu Fatine? I can never quite remember, 'cause I'm not in my right mind since I met you. No one corrupts the way you do. You know it's true. Oh, it's what you'll do to me. Oh, and all humanity. Oh, you'll rise up from the sea. Oh, kill everyone slowly, except the ones like me. Hey there, Cthulhu. I've been studying your gospel, the Necronomicon. It gives me nightmares, something awful, where I see the death of all reality. It fills me with glee. So when the stars are right, you'll come and do your worst, but that's okay, because I know you'll eat the cultists like me first when you get here. I know that day is drawing near. I have no fear. Oh, it's what you'll do to me. Oh, and all humanity. Oh, you'll rise up from the sea. Oh, kill everyone slowly. A billion light years seems so far below the sea, beyond the stars of these humans' putrid souls. You'll drink your fill. The fools will all make fun of me, but I'll just laugh maniacally, 'cause no one's ever suffered like they will. Cthulhu, I can promise you that by the time this cult gets through, the world will never, ever be the same. Praise your dark name. Boy, that's really quite a mouthful. Can't quite cram it in my noggin, not today. I try to say it anyway. I feel my soul begin to fray. Still I await that fractious day, Cthulhu Calais. Oh, you'll rise up from the sea. but me. Everyone but me.
That, of course, was Eben Brooks with his song Hey There Cthulhu, which is, relates back, of course, to the Dunwich Horror episode of Martian Driving Podcast. I nearly said Paleo Cinema. So let's move on to Transylvania at the turn of the 20th century with the Hammer horror film Brides of Dracula, starring Peter Cushing, Yvonne Munlar, David Peel, and Martita Hunt.
Listen to the beat of your heart, Marianne. You hear the beat of fear within you, fear that will rise to a shattering crescendo of terror. You have strayed into a world of evil, where frightened people are held in the grip of unearthly horror. Beware of pity for the handsome prisoner in the Castle Meister. Beware of love, for in your heart is only the pulsating throb of terror. Starring Peter Cushing as the Doctor locked in mortal combat with overwhelming evil. Also starring Freda Jackson as Greta, who served the vampires with insane loyalty.
You needn't be afraid, she's dead.
Martita Hunt, the Baroness, victim of her own son. Beautifully Von Morlor, France's latest sex kitten, as Marianne, whose beauty was her passport to the twilight world of the undead. David Peel as the Baron, blindingly handsome, yet his kiss transformed the most beautiful girls into monsters.
So Brides of Dracula is a 1960 Hammer horror film. Really interesting cast. It's got Peter Cushing as Dr. Van Helsing, Martita Hunt as Baroness Meinster, the mother of Baron Meinster, Yvonne Munlar as Marie Danielle, a young woman who's going to be a student teacher at a ladies' college in Transylvania, Freda Jackson as Greta, who is a servant of the Meinsters, David Peel as Baron Meinster, and Miles Mallison as Dr. Tobler, who gets a couple of really fun scenes. Then, of course, we have Andre Melle as Gina, who is one of Marianne's friends at the school. And we even get a bit at the start with Michael Ripper, one of the stalwarts of Hammer horror films, playing the coachman at the start of the movie and kind of camping it up a little bit in the brief time he has in the role. If you have a look through Michael Ripper's IMDb, there are what is known in the trade as a shit ton of roles for him in Hammer horror films and also in television and movies as well. He was in The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, amongst other things. But it's always a fun Hammer horror film when you see Michael Ripper in there somewhere playing a kind of tavern owner or a coachman or just some kind of ancillary working class character in one of our Hammer's oeuvre. Now, this movie was originally supposed to star Christopher Lee, but he didn't want to do it, so Peter Cushing went it alone. The weak spot in the film is Baron Meinster, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. The plot's fairly simple. Marianne Danielle, a young French schoolteacher, is en route to take up a position in Transylvania. She's abandoned at a village inn by her coach driver. Ignoring warnings of the locals, she accepts the offer of Baroness Meinster to spend the night at her castle. There she sees the, and this is Wikipedia by the way, there she sees the Baron's handsome son, who she is told is insane and kept confined. When she sneaks into his quarters to meet him, she's shocked to find him chained by the leg to the wall. When he tells her that his mother has usurped his rightful lands and pleads for her help, she agrees to steal the key to his chain from the Baroness's bedroom.
Discovering this, the Baroness is horrified, yet when her son appears, she obeys him and accompanies him back to his rooms. Later, Marianne discovers the Baroness's servant, Greta, who is also taking care of the Baron since he was a baby, in hysterics. She shows Marianne the Baroness's corpse and the puncture marks on her throat. Marianne flees into the night. And then she meets Dr. Van Helsing, who looks after her, and Van Helsing, of course, being the go-to guy for vampire lore, discovers that Baron Meister is a vampire and that the Baroness has risen from the dead as well. Now, as usual, this has got Hammer's beautiful, rich colour, the Technicolor, incredibly kind of vital and full of colours. Things like Baroness Meister's purple clothing really pop in this film. And there are, in spite of the fact that it is a Hammer horror film and it is kind of entertainment and light, there are some nice bits of acting in this one by women. The first one I'll mention is Greta, played by a character actress who had a long career on the stage as well. Frieda Jackson. Her Greta is a really great character. She gets to play it over the top and theatrical, but there's a real intensity to her acting in this, which I like a lot. It really does show us somebody who's been on the stage and on film for decades, really kind of giving her A game to something which was looked down on by people on the stage in England. Though doing a Hammer horror film or any kind of B or C picture was kind of looked as slumming it by a number of theatrical lovies at the time. But Frieda Jackson really gives it a good go here. She's really magnetic and hypnotising in this film. The other person of interest in this one, for me at least, is Martita Hunt, who plays the Baroness. Now, Martita Hunt in this film as well goes through a character arc. She's imperious as the Baroness at the start of the film, where she meets young Marianne and invites her back to the castle. Martita Hunt, born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, of English parents, but she came to England at an early time, started out in the Liverpool rep, and became a really well-known stage actor in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s. She was in all of the really good stuff. She did Shakespeare. She did a whole bunch of Oscar Wilde stuff. So she was really well known as a character actor. She was also, oddly enough, in Bonjour Tristesse, again, which I talked about on a recent Paleo Cinema podcast. Didn't have much of a role in that one, but she was kind of interesting. But as the Baroness, she goes from being kind of predatory to pathetic in the arc of the film, and I like her acting. She really does, again, like Frieda Jackson, given that opportunity, she really does bring her A-game to it, and I really like her Baroness in this film, who, when she turns into a vampire, is embarrassed by it. She hides her fangs behind a veil. She's kind of diffident and shy and ashamed of what she's done to her son and what was done to her by her son as well. So it's kind of a twisted and dark mother love she has, and on Mother's Day is quite an apt thing to say. But I really like Martita Hunt in this. She did a few other things on stage and on film in particular, but in this I really like her. I think that Jimmy Sangster's script really does give her something to chew and give her an opportunity to show her acting chops. And even though it's a kind of a secondary role in a horror film, I think that her acting in this is quite memorable. Unfortunately, that can't be said for David Peel as Baron Meister. His Baron Meister is a kind of weak and slightly effeminate character in a lot of ways. Yes, he's blonde and kind of good-looking, but doesn't bring much to it. I think that may be one of the reasons why in the Anno Dracula series of books, Kim Newman has Baron Meister as a character in the alternate universe where Dracula succeeds rather than fails, as in the Bram Stoker novel. Baron Meister is a much more interesting character in Kim Newman's books because at one stage he becomes Prime Minister of England, but nonetheless he is a kind of politician and a kind of weak, watered-down Dracula. And I think that's kind of apt. David Peel didn't act for very long after he made this film. He went on to be a fine art dealer, and he did very, very well in that. His career as an actor failed, but he followed a passion, and that passion did him very great. He was a real estate agent, antiques dealer, and a fine art dealer. and died in 1981, which would have made him only like 61 years old at the time, so he died fairly early. But he only made a handful of films, and maybe acting wasn't his thing, but Hammer had a tendency to kind of do that. Now, Peter Cushing, I like in this film. Peter Cushing is great. He's kind of familiar with the role of Van Helsing, having played it in the original 1958 Hammer version of Dracula. And when I said original Hammer version, I mean it's not the original version of Dracula, but it's the first Hammer version of Dracula. And in this one, he gets to swash and buckle a lot. He leaps from ropes. He gets to burn a vampire bite off his neck with a hot brand. He really does jump around a lot, and he's quite athletic and energetic in this film. And that's kind of, I like that. I like to see that with Peter Cushing. It really is a role where he gets to do more than just stand around and talk intensely. And that really works for me. Now, Yvonne Meloir, who plays Marianne, yeah, again, you know, English wasn't her first language, and her English was kind of thickly accented. But she does what's required of the role, which is to be the beautiful heroine who is there to scream and be kind of, yeah. And the only active thing she really does is give the key to the chains to Baron Meinster. But nonetheless, a lot of these actors weren't hired for their acting skills as much as their looks, and she was, as the trailer says, they were kind of advertising and pumping her up as a French sex kitten kind of character, this being only a few years after And God Created Woman brought Brigitte Bardot to everyone's attention, so attractive French starlets were really popular in a number of places. French starlets were to early 1960s cinema what internet stars are to 2010 cinema. They get a role because of where they're from rather than who they are. But having said that, it's a bit different. We don't have that kind of cold, aristocratic look that Christopher Lee brought to the role of Dracula in this film. But that kind of works because it gives space to other actors. Freda Jackson essentially playing Renfrew to Baron Meinster's Dracula, in a sense. Has room to expand that role in the scene she's in. And the Baroness brings a certain something to it that Dracula had been in this movie, we wouldn't have had the character of the Baroness, and we wouldn't have had her arc as a character. And the fact that she gets young girls for her son to feed on in that kind of twisted mother love kind of thing, and then ultimately becomes a victim of her son and becomes a vampire herself. That's quite a meaty role, and I really am incredibly fond of Martita Hunt in this role. I really like what she does with it. And her Baroness ultimately ends up being the most memorable character in the movie. Then we've got another character actor who comes in as Dr. Tobler, a doctor who is at the ladies' college where Marianne works. And he's played by Miles Mallison, an actor who had a long career, eventually, unfortunately, failing eyesight, ended his stage, movie, and television career as well. But Miles Mallison, with his very, very, very bad toupee, playing the kind of greedy Dr. Tobler, is in there almost as comic relief. Everyone's taking things a bit too seriously. Then we got Dr. Tobler coming in because one of the girls at the school has been bitten by a vampire, this, of course, being Andre Melle's Gina, and he has to do the kind of analysis of what happened to her, along with Dr. Van Helsing, who helps out, though Dr. Tobler does say he's not sharing the fee for the service, and Van Helsing's not particularly interested in that anyway. But Miles Mallison, really interesting guy. He was not only an actor, he had a number of different skill sets, let's say. He was a playwright and a screenwriter as well. He did a number of plays about the First World War, which were made and produced during the First World War, which was critical of war as an option in international diplomacy. He was a very much, unlike the characters he played, he was very much a lefty. But he wrote a screenwriter. He wrote a movie about Nell Gwynn, about Cecil Rhodes, and about Queen Victoria in the 1930s for the English film industry as well, and was very well regarded as a screenwriter. So even though he was playing buffoons in the movies we mostly know him from, Miles Mallison really did have a lot more to go with. And he was in some great movies as well. He was in Peeping Tom. He plays one of the guys who's trying to get the pawn in the news agency under the counter. In The Thief of Baghdad, he plays one of the wazirs. He's in Kind Hearts and Coronets, for instance. Any number of films, you'll see Miles Mallison pop up. He's in The Man in the White Suit, the Alec Guinness movie, which I really should do for a Martian Driving podcast. And I always like Miles Mallison in films for that. Really, one of those jobbing character actors that we love to see in cinema. Freda Jackson as well was in a number of films. She was in Clash of the Titans, the original version. She was in the 1946 Great Expectations, which was a fantastic film. Tom Jones with Albert Finney, she was in that as well. She was also in A Canterbury Tale, the Powell and Pressburger movie in 1944. Which I didn't notice, but I've talked about that on a Paleo Cinema podcast. If you go back, you can find the episode where I talked about A Canterbury Tale, which is quite an interesting movie filmed and set during World War II in Canterbury in England. But that's the lovely thing about this point of history with Hammer Films. There are people who are involved in making these films who are kind of deeply entwined with English film history and contributed really well to it. And they bring all of that experience and all of that knowledge and all of that long skill gathering time, which is phrased very badly there, by the way, to these kind of projects. And they would not be anywhere near as good as they are had these people not been a part of it. And that's one of the reasons why I love character actors. People who kind of come in and do small roles in TV shows or are playing secondary or tertiary characters in movies, but you know them from when they, for instance, these days you get a bunch of people who come in, you knew them when they were young, kind of up and coming, beautiful young actors in the 1970s and 1980s, and some of them have kind of negotiated their way through stage and screen and become really interesting character actors when their looks faded and they're not as pretty and they're not as lust worthy to the audience as once they were. And it's a fascinating thing, that arc of an actor's life and the uncertainty of it as a career choice, being an actor where you don't know whether you're going to have a career from one job to the next, and you don't know whether all of those skills you built up and all of those relationships and all of those tricks of the trade and all of those tricks for remembering lines and learning to create a character out of very thin source material at times, all of those wonderful imaginative gifts, you don't know whether you're going to keep using them in the next 6 months. And that's probably why some character actors go into episodic television, certainty in their lives and their career. But I'm in awe and really love character actors for that reason, that that kind of vagabond nomadic lifestyle that they lead, which is obviously much more romantic in my mind than it actually is to live. But nonetheless, I've got immense respect for them. One of the reasons why that's come to mind is I went and saw our friend from the podcast, Grant Watson's directorial Shakespearean debut. He's directed other plays, but he directed an all-female version of Coriolanus for the Hartspring Theatre, which I went and saw about a week and a bit ago on stage. Very small theatre with very bad seating, cast of 10 women all playing all the roles in Coriolanus, the Shakespeare play. One of Shakespeare's minor plays and not one of his best, but the sets were crazily minimal. I think some of them were made out of packing crates and pallets and things like that. But it was riveting just seeing actors live in front of you, you know, plying their trade. It really did kind of refresh me for watching cinema in a slightly different way. And that's probably a reason why I should go to more plays. Seeing actors in front of you live refreshes you for watching them in cinema. You kind of, I'm not sure there's a transmission of energy there or a transmission of wonder that you get from a live theatrical performance that is different in a lot of ways to what you get from watching a movie, when you can pause the movie, get up, go and take a piss, grab a cup of coffee, come back to the movie when you've got an hour and 50 minutes, I think it was, without an intermission of Coriolanus. And I was riveted for every second of it. I let myself ease into the Shakespearean language. The acting was universally, in all 10 of the actors involved, good. and that kind of magic that you get on a fairly small stage with sets that are made out of wire mesh and wooden pallets, and giving us an illusion of it being a battle in a Roman city. And yeah, there's a magic there that really did refresh me. And thanks to Grant for putting on the production, and Heartspring Theatre as well, and of course all of the actors. Sonia Marcon, Grant's wife, was also in the play, playing one of the main villainous characters, and she was very good in that as well. And Sonia's beat was on the very early Martian Driver podcast as well. One of the reasons why I'm mentioning this is, in about a month's time, at Continuum 12, the local science fiction convention, I'm doing a live recording of Martian Drive-In podcast with Narelle Harris and with Grant Watson as well. So we're recording it live. We're going to use my little mobile mic that has the really great sound quality in front of a live audience. Hopefully we'll get a bigger audience than we did last time. But we're actually talking about the return of Captain Invincible, an Australian superhero movie from the 1980s, starring Alan Arkin and a bunch of really good Australian actors. So we're going to do that live. It's a two-hour session during the convention. It helps them out because they've got a lot of time to film in several different conference rooms. And I'm looking forward to that. Again, it's that performance thing that I just mentioned. You get an energy from doing a podcast in front of an audience that you don't get from doing it in the man cave here by yourself the way I do. Though it does have a tendency to make me into a show-off and a smarty pants when I do it. But I'll try to rein that in a little bit, and I'll get the other two to help me with that. But I'm really looking forward to doing that as well. It'll take a little bit of editing, of course, to bring it down to where it needs to be. But, yeah, that's something to look forward to on the podcast. Now, that's about it this time around. Again, thank you for listening. Thank you to the Patreon subscribers for supporting the podcast and making it pay for itself, which is kind of nice. And it gives me a little wherewithal to get movies like The Towering Inferno, which I will talk about in a future Paleo Cinema podcast. I'm getting the names of the podcasts mixed up today. Maybe I'm a little tired. Who knows? But anyway, look after yourselves. Take care. Life gets better if you let it, and if you're there for the opportunities. Yes, shit happens, but shit passes as well. And so to everybody going through rough times at the moment, you've got my very best wishes. You'll get through it in one way or the other. If you die, you die. Then you're through it. If you don't die, you'll find a way to get up every morning, to do what you need to do, to get out there. And occasionally there'll be moments of grace and moments of wonder. You'll see a movie you've never seen before that delights you. You'll meet somebody. You'll have a meal. You'll have a drink. One, anything. Life has great moments in it. You've just got to leave yourself open to them. So, again, thank you for listening. And as usual, the credits in the style of movie credits for our wonderful Patreon subscribers, and you can go to patreon.com/paleocinema, throw a dollar a month at me, and I'll be a very happy chappy. So take care of yourselves, and I'll be back very soon with another podcast. And now here are the podcast credits. I'd like to thank Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, our Technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tamora, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Solomon, our werewolf consultant, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H., our set photographer, and the two extras, Mark D. and David L. Thank you to all of the podcast supporters.